My name is Paul Weber, and it is my pleasure to welcome everyone to the teleclass Bugs, Blood, and Barrier Breaches, and a special welcome to all of you who are joining your first teleclass today. I know that it will be a worthwhile experience for you. And I can say with certainty that it will be a worthwhile experience because I know today's faculty. Back in August of this year, Professor Adriano Duse gave a teleclass that looked at the big picture of infectious disease in Africa and some of the pathogens that had their very origins on that continent. It was a wonderful teleclass, and we did receive quite a lot of very gracious notes from those of you who are listening. Today's teleclass again features my friend Dr. Adriano Duse of Johannesburg, South Africa. Dr. Duse is a well-recognized name in global infection control and particularly in bloodborne diseases. His presentation today will review a little bit of what he talked about in August, and he'll move on to look particularly at lessons from Africa on the control of bloodborne pathogens. To present the teleclass, Bugs, Blood, and Barrier Breaches, from the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, I am honored to introduce Dr. Adriano Duse. Adrian.
Well, thank you very much, Paul, and greetings to all our listeners, and a very, very warm welcome from South Africa to this teleclass. As Paul has already mentioned, we have covered some of the material previously in August, but the main focus of this evening's teleclass is to really look at the type of organisms that are of concern to us with respect to bloodborne pathogens within our continent. And again, if I take you back to the last presentation earlier this year, you'll realize that many of our bloodborne pathogens are effectively exported to many parts of the world. So in the same way as we encounter them fairly often, you can be almost certain that one day you will encounter them in your own facility. So if I could take you to the first slide, I want to remind you that my favorite statement is the African notion that we always produce something new. Captured by Pliny the Elder, a Roman statesman, who said in a very plagiaristic fashion that from Africa always something new arises, ex Africa semper aliquid nova. And indeed, we have a wide variety of interesting organisms that are unique to South Africa, unique to the African continent, and indeed, in fact, are effectively transported and exported to other parts of the world. If you move to the next slide, I'm going to revise an index case of a very important case of a non-endemic disease in Johannesburg that we had to review, which really brought us to think very carefully about infection control issues and reminded us of the danger of assuming that non-endemic viruses would not be a threat to our healthcare workers in our country. The index case really goes back to the year 1996, where a 46-year-old anesthetic assistant that worked in a private clinic in Johannesburg became ill with a fever on the 2nd of November. On the 5th of November, she complained of a severe headache, and she was then admitted subsequently on the 6th with a diagnosis of a possible viral encephalitis. Cerebrospinal fluid findings were not very attractive or appealing. In fact, they showed nothing of significance. But what was very interesting and missed by the physicians treating this patient was that she had already developed a leukopenia, a marked drop in platelets, thrombocytopenia, and deranged liver function tests. And over a period of time, her renal function deteriorated to the point where on the 13th of November, she required dialysis. Round about the 9th of November, it was decided that, in fact, an infective screen should be performed on this patient. And this infective screen included the attempt to diagnose a wide variety of important causes of pyrexial disease of infectious etiology. And amongst these causes was an agent, the Ebola virus. On the 14th of the 11th, a very presumptive laboratory diagnosis of Ebola virus was made, and this was more definitively confirmed on the 15th of November. Between the 16th and the 22nd, the patient was transferred to our own hospital. She was in a critical condition, she was hemorrhaging, and very interestingly, as usual, she was transported from one facility to another with secondary nosocomial bacterial and fungal infections. She had a Staph aureus and a Candida albicans in her bloodstream, and she demised subsequently after developing a large intracranial hemorrhage on the 22nd of November. It is really our belief that at the point that she was transferred to a hospital, she was probably at her least viremic state. There seems to be, in fact, some association with the development of antibodies, although these are not neutralizing in Ebola disease, and, in fact, clinical resolution or recovery from the disease. And at this point, probably the patient was at her least antigenemic, which is quite possible that her hemorrhaging and septic shock was really actually caused largely by the bacterial and fungal infections that were superimposed on Ebola disease. Now, the most important thing on the next slide is that Marin Nahana was a classical example of a person who, during the course of duty and whilst being exposed to blood, in fact, vast amounts of blood, from a patient who was imported from Gabon with a pyrex of unknown origin, acquired, in fact, this lethal infection, which you normally do not find in the country. And on the right-hand side of the slide, you'll see an electron micrograph of Ebola virus, an extremely pleomorphic and extremely important and virulent virus, typically found in areas like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan, and other parts of Africa. And we'll discuss these in greater detail shortly. If you move on to the next slide, what is important is that our primary case or source was a very ill 40-year-old doctor who was transported by air from Libreville, Gabon, and admitted to a private healthcare facility in Johannesburg on the 27th of October 1996. Indeed, there seemed to have been a consortium of doctors who made a fair amount of money by transporting critically ill patients from other parts of Africa to first-class hospitals within our own country. And frequently there was no screening method to try and determine what the underlying pathology was in the people that were brought across. On the 29th of October, our anesthetic assistant was known to have been exposed to a large amount of the patient's blood whilst she was assisting in a central venous catheter insertion and was involved in a subsequent process of mopping up the blood that had oozed from the site. The patient, interestingly, did not present with a typical Ebola picture that you might read in textbooks. In fact, the patient was misdiagnosed as suffering from a polymyositis overlap syndrome, and quite strangely, after having been given hydrocortisone, he promptly started improving, almost from a prostrate state to a very much active state walking around the ward, and was discharged on the 11th of November 1996. It was really due to a cascade of events from the Department of Health, which led to contact tracing, that the patient was traced to a convalescence home in Johannesburg on the 16th of November. And blood drawn from the patient, showing Ebola titers of greater than 512, confirmed that he was indeed, in fact, the primary case or the source of infection. What was important in all of these investigations is that several nurses remembered Marin Nahana, the anesthetic assistant, stating categorically that she had nursed a very, very sick patient from Gabon. And this gave them a clue of who to pursue and where to go. From a nosocomial implication point of view, we really had to critically review our South African viral hemorrhagic fever infection control practices. And amongst this review was to really try and estimate the risk of acquiring bloodborne disease from non-endemic bloodborne pathogens within our own country. So what I intend to do is I want to tell you that although our general initial feeling, next slide please, is to complicate our levels of containment and barrier precautions by using, for instance, Raquel respirators during the delivery of nursing and processing of blood. By understanding that a lot of these blood-borne viruses within the African context are spread by the contact route, we really do feel that, in fact, complicated apparatus such as Raquel respirators are more of a hindrance to patient care and paradoxically may actually increase risk of needle stick injuries due to clumsiness and manipulations than people who are more simply clad. And if you look at the bottom left-hand side, you'll see that when people dealt with the outbreak in Kikwit, for instance, in 1995, all that they used and was highly effective in preventing the transmission of Ebola virus was simple, in fact, protective equipment measures such as wearing of masks, wearing of gloves, and even wearing of plastic aprons or gowns that were impervious to blood and body fluids. And so we redefined, in fact, our healthcare dress code to what you see on the lower right-hand side of the slide. Protect the mucous membranes, protect the skin, and make sure that you have, in fact, a decent gown that does not allow the water or blood to permeate through it. So an impervious gown would be important. In facilities where this can't be afforded, we simply substitute, in fact, the gown by a plastic apron which is placed under an ordinary cotton woven gown. So if you move to the next slide, the objective of this presentation is really to actually show you some of the blood-borne pathogens that are really endemic to the African continent and that are transmissible by contaminated medical paraphernalia. I want to point out to you that you should not be very smug about the fact that you may never encounter these organisms, because with human migration, we import and export these microbes very effectively, hence the beginning of the talk, out of Africa, and the Latin quote. I also want to tell you some of the case scenarios that we sometimes find in South Africa that really look at some fairly typical, as well as unconventional, bizarre, and even sinister modes of transmission of blood-borne pathogens. And finally conclude by looking at possible preventive strategies to control the transmission of blood-borne pathogens within our own setting of limited resources. So moving to the next slide, I'm going to briefly review some viruses that are not only endemic necessarily to Africa, but also present in other parts of the world, but concentrate on things like the viral hemorrhagic fever agents, which are mainly African in etiology in this presentation, human immunodeficiency virus, which seems to have its origins on the African continent, various organisms such as hepatitis B and C, which may be found worldwide, but certainly pose an important threat to healthcare workers in South Africa, as well as other slightly more unusual organisms. So let's start with the viruses, next slide, and let's look at, in fact, Lassa virus. We have learned that it's really extremely important to understand the biological behavior of a virus and the way in which infection is transmitted and propagated, in fact, in a nosocomial environment. And at the end of the day, the basic lesson that we always come down to is that simple infection control measures, which can really be carried out by all facilities, even the most under-resourced facility in our country, can go a long way in protecting people against these formidable diseases. Lassa fever is the first virus that I'm going to discuss. Described in the 1950s in the West African region and isolated in Jos, northern Nigeria, in 1969. We know that from the area spanning from the Nigeria region to Guinea, we have approximately 5,000 deaths a year from this disease. In the year 2000, 5 cases were exported from Sierra Leone, where there was an outbreak, to Europe, an example of the out-of-Africa phenomenon. And I think all of you are aware of the MMWR report on October 1, 2004, where there was an imported case of Lassa fever into New Jersey in 2004. The patient was actually a businessman who was born in Liberia and had resided in the United States for 5 years. And during the 4-month period preceding hospitalization, he had been to West Africa, commuting frequently between Liberia and Sierra Leone, where he owned several farms. And one day in August, he started experiencing fever, he had chills, a sore throat, diarrhea and back pain. And 2 days later, he left Freetown in Sierra Leone and traveled by airplane through London, England, eventually arriving into New Jersey, and traveled then from New York to his home by train. The patient was in fact quite sick and sought treatment within hours of his arrival. And unfortunately, before ribavirin intravenous administration could be started, the patient really died. And it took him 6 hours to die after the onset of symptoms, and particularly after the third and fourth day of hospitalization, despite aggressive treatment with antimalarials and antibiotics, which people presumably had assumed would have an effect. Now, from a biological point of view, we find that most of these formidable pathogens are really actually easily inactivated. They're easily inactivated for laboratory tests so that we can actually protect laboratory workers, but frequently the inactivation techniques do not actually always allow for reliable reporting of results. For instance, heating blood or serum at 56 degrees may compromise some of the parameters that we require in order to actually get a profile of the patient's general metabolic and electrolyte status. We know that beta-propionylactone treatment can also interfere with liver function test results, for instance. So we generally tend to take the approach that although laboratory workers are definitely at risk for infection, they need to apply proper infection control precautions in the laboratory, use, in fact, all the appropriate measures of disposal of any waste that is generated, disposal of blood so that it is effectively incinerated and removed, and at the end of the day also report any injuries that may have been sustained during the process. The organism, Lassa virus, is easily disinfected. It can be disinfected using, in fact, phenolics, hypochlorite, peracetic acids. And you'll see that a lot of the propagation of Lassa virus in most of the case studies and amplification of this disease has occurred in the nosocomial setting. We're finding either sharp injuries or ill-advised surgery, blood exposure, contact with contaminated equipment being used between patients has largely been responsible for nosocomial outbreak. So what are the solutions in terms of prevention and treatment? Well, the prevention always goes back to simple infection control and contact precautions. In the hospital setting, ordinary personal protective equipment, the use of gloves, gowns, masks to protect mucous membranes, the disposal of single-use items, especially not using needles and syringes and not reusing gloves, and getting rid of sharps safely are really the things that bring about, in fact, a very safe environment in which propagation doesn't occur. Although intravenous ribavirin is useful for the treatment of the disease, its role in prophylaxis has not been clearly established, but certainly something that might be considered as a last resort in a patient who has really exposed their blood and body fluid to a healthcare worker who has subsequently obtained significant injury. If you move to the next slide, I want to really emphasize that Lassa fever is normally, in the nosocomial setting, the high price of poor medical practice. In 1989, there were two hospital outbreaks in the Imo State in southern central Nigeria, and you'll notice that among 34 cases, there were not only just 20 patients, but also, in fact, amplification of the outbreak amongst healthcare workers, where nurses, surgeons, and physicians were involved. The disease carried a fairly high mortality in the region of 65%, and most of the cases were exposed in hospitals, with the attack rate in one of the two hospitals approaching 55%. Both hospitals on audit were found to be inadequately equipped and staffed. There was clearly very bad medical practice. Parenteral drug rounds really fueled the epidemic because people were sharing syringes between patients, and this clearly was a recipe for disaster. And there was also staff that was infected during emergency surgery and during the delivery of healthcare. The next virus that I want to bring your attention to is, on the next slide, Marburg virus. This is a filovirus, and if you notice, in fact, when it was first described in 1967, it was exported from Africa, from African green monkeys, came from Uganda, to various facilities in Germany and Yugoslavia. And of the 37 cases that were described, lab workers, medical personnel, and caregivers were, in fact, extremely, extremely prominent. What is extremely interesting is that in South Africa, we had, in fact, a case of this disease in 1975, where two backpackers from Australia traveled down the continent and presented with the disease, in fact, in a town called Marburg in South Africa, ironically very different from the one in Germany, which was a coastal town, came down with a fever, were extremely ill. One of the backpackers died. His fiancée, ironically, lived, and the nurse that nursed both of these patients acquired, in fact, infection as a COMD, again through contact with blood and body fluids. There have been subsequent events and outbreaks of Marburg virus disease. These have been described in Zimbabwe, in Kenya, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, Marburg virus is very similar to the Ebola virus, and I think it's important from an infection control perspective to take the responsibility to warn patients that even if they have been able to survive disease and they're convalescing, at least for 3 months post-convalescence, they're really seen, or during the period of convalescence, they should abstain from sexual intercourse, or if they do so, use a condom. Because we know that the virus can survive easily in the semen of a convalescent patient for up to 83 to about 90 days. And we know that the virus can also be survived from various other parts of the body, such as the anterior chamber of the eye. The nosocomial transmission is pretty similar to that of Ebola virus, which we're going to go into detail in the following slide. But notice that prevention and treatment is always exactly the same. Infection control, isolation of patients, personal protective equipment, very importantly, avoid reuse of inadequately sterilized equipment, and crucial is a sharps and waste disposal policy. On the next slide, you'll see Ebola virus, which is a filovirus, which is almost morphologically identical to Marburg virus under the electron microscope. Ebola virus was described in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or Zaire as it was then known, in Yumbuku in 1976. It was also responsible for an important outbreak in 1995 in Kikwit in the same Democratic Republic of Congo, where of 316 cases, nosocomial amplification occurred, whereby 25% of these cases were healthcare workers. You may all be aware of the outbreak, which coincided with, in fact, the travel to South Africa of our Gabonese doctor, that raged from 1994 to 1996, and another outbreak involving Gabon and the Democratic Republic of Congo from 2001 to 2002. Now, the Ebola DRC strain is a particularly virulent strain of the virus and carries the highest mortality of the 4 strains that are mentioned in the slide. Indeed, the mortality in the absence of ICU facilities and appropriate supportive therapy for patients can range between 60 and easily 80 to 90%. So infection with this organism is really extremely, extremely dramatic and quite severe. Ebola Sudan is slightly less virulent, and outbreaks have been described of this particular strain of virus in 1976, 1979, and in Uganda over 2000-2001. Ebola Sudan seems to have a slightly lower mortality than Ebola DRC, or Ebola Zaire as it used to be called, with mortality rates ranging from about 40 to 60%. The two other strains of Ebola that are really not largely common or of human concern. Ebola Cote d'Ivoire was isolated in 1994 from a laboratory worker who went to the Ivory Coast and performed certain experiments on primates. She became infected with this different strain of Ebola virus and was flown to Switzerland, where she got very good hospitalization, fortunately survived infection. And then you may all be aware of Ebola Reston. This is probably the only Ebola virus strain that is thought to be spread possibly by the airborne route. And this was described in an Animal House facility in Reston in Virginia, where, again, macaque monkeys imported from the Philippines, for instance, gave rise to outbreaks in various parts of the world, including in Italy in 1996. Now, Ebola virus, as we've mentioned to you, like Marburg, may survive in semen of convalescent patients for a period of time. So, ironically, in a convalescent patient who has survived this very severe infection, sexual transmission of this virus is a possibility. What is really quite interesting, following a very careful analysis, and this might perhaps be an explanation for Marin Nahana's, our anesthetic assistant's infection, who was allegedly fully gloved and used all the protective precautions, although this was not confirmed, is that there is a finding of abundant viral antigens and particles on the skin of these Ebola hemorrhagic fever patients. And one wonders whether this abundance of viral antigens, which frequently precedes the hemorrhaging, could play a possible etiology for contact transmission in patients who claim that they have never really had real contact with blood or body fluid. Clearly, Marin Nahana did have contact with blood and high-risk body fluids. She was exposed to large amounts of blood during the CBC insertion. And I think it is widely accepted that possibly the contact with blood and high-risk fluids is the predominant mode of spread. Now, this does not include or exclude the fact that if, for instance, you hose down an animal house facility where you're conducting Ebola experiments with high jet hoses, airborne transmission of such a virus couldn't occur. But it's extremely rare in the nosocomial setting, and so we always go back to contact precautions, which are really doable in most of our healthcare facilities. Percutaneous exposure, again, is important. A very good example, again, of a bloodborne pathogen through unsterilized needles, laboratory accident, and possibly by person-to-person, having direct contact with the patient with particularly secretions such as blood, stool, and vomitus. What is quite important is that in the African continent, given the concept of the importance of bloodborne transmission of organisms, we have shown, certainly from the Tikrit outbreak, that virus can survive in used syringes that have been left at ambient temperatures with encrusted blood very easily for 7 and indeed up to 14 days. And this is at tropical temperatures that sometimes actually range from 35 to 41 degrees. This has clear implications for people who pick up syringes and reuse them, for children that play, for instance, in waste dumps, and pretend by doing a doctor-patient as a type of play-out, possibly stab themselves with this. And, of course, intravenous drug abusers will look at any syringe as a possible vehicle for transmission of a narcotic or injectable, and frequently, unfortunately, they also sort of transmit diseases which may be quite devastating. So although there's no particular treatment other than supportive for Ebola virus, how do we prevent the bloodborne amplification or exposure of this? We go back to the simple principles of infection control. And again, in African continent, which is under-resourced, we go back to contact precautions and we try and keep things as simple as possible. I just want to briefly mention that handling of the dead is very important in hemorrhagic fevers. In some African cultures, it's important to manually evacuate the bowel of the dead as a sign of respect before burial. And this clearly, in a patient with extensive gastrointestinal hemorrhages, will bring about, in fact, direct physical contact with huge amounts of blood. And disease following the handling of the dead from these viruses has been well described. The next agent that I want to take you on the next slide is Congo-Crimean hemorrhagic fever virus. Although this virus is endemic in many parts of the world and is widespread in Eastern Europe, in Asia, in the Middle East, and China, it's certainly, in fact, actually fairly diffusely spread in Africa. The virus is not entirely an African entity, although we have the fame of having isolated it in the Belgian Congo in 1968, this hemorrhagic fever was actually described in the 1930s by the Soviet Union. In South Africa, the first case was diagnosed in 1981. It's endemic to our country, and usually around about this time of the year, when it approaches Christmas and we're all ready for a holiday, we normally get, in fact, a case. And we all called immediately to see this case and to assess them, and this usually interrupts what could have been a wonderful, restful period. We see one a year, and for whatever reason, December is a very good month for us to see these patients. Now, what is quite interesting in South Africa is that the outbreak of Congo-Crimean hemorrhagic fever occurred amongst abattoir workers in 1996. And it's believed that either the ostriches that were being slaughtered carried ticks, which would have been responsible for the zoonotic transmission of the virus to the abattoir workers. But very importantly, we need to move back to the fact that, in fact, through nosocomial transmission, in all our history of Congo-Crimean hemorrhagic fever, we've seen surgeons, nursing staff, and other healthcare workers come down with the disease. And we know that direct contact, again, with blood, sharps, injuries, failure to observe proper barrier nursing techniques is important. And other than in the morgue situation, where people might, for instance, saw patients open during autopsy in order to try and get a diagnosis, particularly if they go for certain organs, the organism can certainly be made airborne. Interestingly, the virus, if you're worried about ostriches, does not survive very easily in dried blood. And at high temperatures, if you eat your ostrich meat, which is high in protein and very good for the health-conscious people that want to be lean and beautiful, the virus usually is, in fact, easily inactivated. When ostrich meat is matured and there's a drop in pH, also the virus does not really withstand those pH conditions very well. Now, we've been told typically in the literature that virus survives in post-mortem tissues and in cadavers possibly for up to 7 days. We were promised in various articles and from our National Institute for Virology that they had never seen survival in post-mortem specimens or in cadavers beyond 3 days beyond the time of death. But one very shrewd pathologist who conducted the post-mortem was not so convinced and sent material to the National Institute for Virology in South Africa. And much to his horror, the body was 9 days post-mortem, and it in fact had an extremely viable yield of Congo-Crimean hemorrhagic fever. So we're always cautious about what we're told. Remember that Ebola can survive under very, very dire conditions in syringes for long periods of time. And we're always a bit cautious about taking 7 days or 3 days or any other day as a cut-off point where we assume that infectivity no longer occurs. Notice that prevention and treatment is no different from all the other hemorrhagic fevers, except that there have been, although very small case studies, instances where post-exposure prophylaxis with ribavirin has been possibly effective, and we certainly implement that principle or that strategy in our country. So if you move to the next slide, what is important is that you can really keep these formidable agents that are not transmissible by the airborne route that we find on our own continent really in check by going back to the basics of infection control. Isolate the patient, use sensible and affordable personal protective equipment. Make sure that you reinforce the importance of standard and contact precautions. Explain to people how to safely disinfect spills. Don't go overboard, incinerate everything, including patients and staff and contact, which tends to be the usual neurotic reaction when you come up with a virus that is so threatening to people. Very importantly, dispose of those sharps and contaminated waste in areas where the disposal of waste is not contained or controlled. People with access medical paraphernalia and may sustain, in fact, injuries with needles, syringes, and acquired bloodborne virus infection via this route. Remember the concept of safe handling and burial of corpses, again, preventing contact with hemorrhagic organs of a patient who's just died from a VHF. And most importantly, educate families so they can understand why they must not have this contact without appropriate precautions if they want to avoid acquisition of these formidable agents. Moving on to the next slide, we often get asked about the viability of HIV 1 and 2, a disease that is extremely common on our continent, and in the most recent antenatal clinic study, which, remember, would preclude automatically people who either don't present to these clinics or who are on oral contraceptives, has indicated that our seroprevalence is probably in the region of about 27%. So we feel quite strongly that in the region of 1 in 5 to possibly much more optimistically 1 in 9 South Africans are infected with HIV. And there's a lot of contrasting information about how prevalent this infection is, and there are certain political motives that give rise to this confusing information. HIV is most probably of African origin. There's a lot of molecular evidence and that the virus transgressed, if it's HIV-1, from pan-troglodytes troglodytes, and it was most likely a mutant of simian immunodeficiency virus that really crossed species to human population. HIV-2 seems to have arisen from simian immunodeficiency virus, which infected Sutimangabe monkeys on our continent. And there seems to be plenty of evidence to suggest that probably these viruses were already in fact present and had crossed species as early as the 1950s, if not earlier. Now, in terms of properties and transmission of these viruses, in experimental studies using, in fact, spiked syringes with blood, it was shown that although the viral viability decreases markedly within the first week after the syringes have been spiked, in principle, the virus, depending on viral load and how it's been spiked, can survive in syringes for up to 4 weeks. Imagine syringes in an intravenous drug-abused frequented park that are picked up and used for the delivery of narcotics. Imagine syringes on our unprotected waste dumps in South Africa and in many parts of the African continent. Imagine how these syringes could so easily become a vehicle for bloodborne virus transmission. Although, in fact, some people have said that viable HIV-1 is really seen beyond 21 hours after death, and some people have actually proposed that you can decrease infectivity if you want to do an autopsy by delaying it for 24 hours, we're not 100% certain based on our South African data that, in fact, the virus does not survive for longer in post-mortem material. Certainly, if we look at samples such as blood, serum from patients, and even tissues, viruses has been shown to survive for up to 11 days, with in fact a mean range of survival of 6 to 14 days in a wide variety of studies. Also interesting was an article that came out where postmortems were carried out and blunt dissection was carried out by morticians and forensic pathologists. And needles that were actually lodged, for instance, in the vasculature of intravenous drug abusers that had broken off, really constituted foreign bodies within the bodies of these patients that resulted in needle stick injuries during the blunt dissection produced or carried out by the forensic pathologist. And these people, therefore, while thinking they were performing the procedure, got a needle stick injury without knowing there was anything. Some people proposed that, in fact, on all autopsies, you should do pre-autopsy x-rays to look for the presence of foreign bodies, but you'll notice there's a shudder or a brrr after that. We already have enough problems in containing infectious patients in our own hospitals that taking them onto trolleys and taking, in fact, corpses into the mortuary in whatever state that they may be, and from the mortuary to a radiology unit is something that we're a little bit cautious about. Note that sharps and splash injuries are in fact important causes of nosocomial transmission of these viruses, and of course an issue of developing countries revolve around the reuse of single-use items, the fact that not all countries have got rigorous transfusion protocols, that plasmapheresis equipment may be used again, and again we go back to in fact prevention modalities, which are good infection control practices, excellent waste disposal, getting rid of any single-use item and sharp, making sure that you're adequately protected with contact precautions, and having policies in place for post-exposure prophylaxis, which is in fact quite effective. If you move to the next slide, I think this is quite important for those of you that might be tempted to do electives in South Africa. A study was carried out in a hospital in the Johannesburg region in 2001, where 98 interns in the one-year internship were surveyed with an anonymous questionnaire. And you'll notice that many of these interns, as predicted, being relatively inexperienced, experienced percutaneous injuries. 33% were aware of the patient's HIV-positive status, and 45% were aware, in fact, of in addition to percutaneous injury, also mucocutaneous exposures to HIV-positive blood. Yet, a very few proportion of these patients really actually reported injuries. Of the percutaneous injuries, only 64% of the respondents reported these injuries to the Occupational Health and Safety Department. And what was very interesting is that, in fact, many of the injuries occurred as a consequence of unexpected patient movement during the stage of withdrawal of the needle, and many of the injuries occurred, in fact, during the first 4 months of internship. Now, although needle recapping is unacceptable in our healthcare facilities, notice that if you cannot control adequately unexpected patient movement, and if injuries occur with withdrawal of the needle, even though you may have, in fact, a lot of protective equipment, you're wearing gloves and you're doing the right things, poor phlebotomy technique will result in exposure. And if we were to take, in fact, only standard precautions, i.e. the usage of personal protective equipment into consideration, only 22% of the interns' percutaneous exposures would have been avoided. So we have introduced in our undergraduate courses to teach our interns how to draw blood, phlebotomy-based courses, so that they're taught how to do venipunctures accurately and carefully and how they can control the whole process so that they do not succumb to injuries from patient jarring, and they withdraw the needle safely and dispose of the sharps appropriately. On the next slide, you will see that in South Africa, our HIV seroprevalence is high, and the biggest part of the problem is that we've got so many confusing statistics. A study carried out by the HSRC, Health Sciences Research Council, showed that about 11.4% of the country's population of 2 years or older living with HIV and AIDS. This is in fact a gross underestimate. We really believe that we're looking in the region of about 27% plus of our population. What is important, however, is that when you see patients in a tertiary healthcare facility or an academic hospital, about 40 to 70% of our patients admitted to our facilities are HIV infected. Now remember that we frequently draw on the guidelines put out by the CDC. In other words, we often look at guidelines from first world countries and low seroprevalences of disease to give us, in fact, some sort of security as to how we should be managing our patients. But you will surely realize this is maybe not applicable. Many of our patients have got, in fact, high viral loads, and therefore the classical exposure risks that are described in CDC guidelines, such as that of 0.3% following needle stick injury, may not be true in South Africa. Many more of our patients in hospital facilities may be in the winter period because our seroprevalence is so high, and therefore looking at overseas guidelines and not really studying the extent of the problem in our own country is potentially dangerous and not appropriate. And as I've mentioned that before from the previous slide, the strategy to minimize sharps injuries must go beyond universal or standard precautions and must include, in fact, careful training of all healthcare professionals to carefully collect blood and phlebotomize patients. If you move to the next slide, we know that although post-exposure prophylaxis is highly effective, it's not necessarily, in fact, a solution. 21 documented failures have been described. In 16 cases, there were people who used zidovudine monotherapy. In 2 cases, DDI and zidovudine were used. And in 3 cases, at least 3 drugs were used. The biggest challenges possibly are issues surrounding compliance. When a study where we looked at medical students, for instance, at our own university, sustaining needlestick injuries whilst being in the wards, we found that at least 76% of the people that started with post-exposure prophylaxis starter packs after 3 days stopped taking the medication and did not progress to 28 days of post-exposure prophylaxis. And we do not have, in fact, much data on the emergence of drug resistance from the public sector, but certainly amongst private sector patients where drug resistant monitoring is affordable, we're seeing this phenomenon. So perhaps the paradigm of using the drugs that have historically been described may be completely inappropriate within the South African scenario, and we need to study this phenomenon very carefully. The challenge of compliance is, of course, that you need to comply with therapy that has not got pleasant effects and has got, in fact, significant side effects for a period of 4 weeks. So you need to counsel the patients regarding side effects, and frequently you have to choose regimens which are probably the least toxic and doses which are the most appropriate. We try and counsel patients and healthcare workers in contact with these patients to avoid unnecessary post-exposure prophylaxis using a risk assessment approach. We do make the drugs accessible to the healthcare workers, and we try and obviously educate regarding seroconversion and abstinence from sexual intercourse until, in fact, patients are declared, or in this case, victims of a needle stick, declared to be HIV-free. It's interesting that there are a number of mixed messages on the next slide in terms of the profile of people who have undergone occupational HIV exposures and the different types of messages are really coming through. For instance, in India, Mumbai, in the first study by Singh, there were 31 cases of occupational HIV exposures. The injuries were mainly in residents and surgeons, and there was 100% efficacy with post-exposure prophylaxis. A different aspect of the same thing is looking at what post-exposure prophylaxis does in terms of adding cost to a healthcare facility by absenteeism in the workplace. And this study looked at the downside of post-exposure prophylaxis, which was associated with significant adverse effects, and looked at, in fact, the time loss, claiming that costs were really extremely significant in the light of the adverse effects that were experienced and the time of work that people took. On the next slide, you'll see, in fact, that there was a six-year longitudinal follow-up of 50 healthcare workers exposed to needle stick injuries of symptomatic HIV-infected patients in India. Only 9 of them used PP, and indeed there were no seroconversions. So many people are beginning to bring out the debate, well, how really effective is PEP, and are the side effects, and is indeed absenteeism, not outweighing its benefit? This is extremely controversial. It's not a notion that I support, but these are the sort of questions that have been asked in under-resourced countries. Regarding, in fact, again, occupational exposure to HIV in pediatricians, a previously undescribed high-risk group, we know that the incidence of injuries in a study by Maria was about 69% amongst all doctors. If they worked after hours, it was in the region of 74%. And in those that knew that they had an HIV exposure and received PCP, there were no seroconversions. So I think there's no doubt that post-exposure prophylaxis is an important strategy. You know, on the next slide, that the proposed PEP guidelines for Europe require needful consensus. Agreement must come from all the European Union countries of what to do. And some countries say, well, what the hell, let's not do a risk assessment on patients, use 3 drugs across the board, because risk assessment is usually at the end of the day left to the patient's discretion. You can counsel as much as you like, but people want to take all the possible agents to prevent seroconversion, and then they may not comply. With regards, in fact, to surveillance of post-exposure prophylaxis in France, over a period of about 6 years, from 1995 to 2001, almost 3,000 healthcare workers sought advice following a significant exposure. 31% needed post-exposure prophylaxis, and in this group there were no seroconversions. Notice, however, that only 41% of the patients actually were followed up to a full 6-month period. So we don't really know what happened to the remainder. And again, compliance with all the monitoring protocols is not always in fact very effective. On the next slide, we're discussing hepatitis B, which is a very well-recognized occupational risk in South Africa. And we know that hepatitis B is related to the nature of contact and whether the patient is a hepatitis B supercarrier, in other words, is HBE antigen positive. We know that in face of HBE antigen positivity, clinical hepatitis occurs in about 22 to 31% of contacts, and serological evidence of infection occur between 37 and 62% of significant contacts. This is, of course, against the background of poor immunization of healthcare workers, something which is not a big issue in our country because we've got pretty good immunization programs. If you're a hepatitis B E antigen negative person, in other words, you're a simple carrier, then the rates of clinical hepatitis are in the region of 1 to 6%, with serological evidence of infection going between 23 to 37%. Next slide will show you that hepatitis B is in fact a long-term survivor. Percutaneous transmission is in fact highly effective. There's still a very large pool of this virus in our country, and we know that survival of virus in dried blood environmental surfaces can actually be documented for at least 1 week, if not more. And you all know about hepatitis B virus transmission from surfaces in hemodialysis units being in fact an important problem. Now, there are other organisms, next slide, than viruses that are important. And we tend to forget that bloodborne pathogens are not always viruses, but in Africa, organisms such as mycobacterial infections are very important, with cutaneous tuberculosis being very well described. If I take you to the next slide, I think you need to understand that about 60% of TB cases in South Africa are co-infected with HIV. We did a study looking at 100 hospitalized HIV-positive South Africans who were all age-defining with CD4 counts of less than 100 CD4 cells per cubic millimeter. And using a BACTEC blood culture technique, it was quite interesting that the point prevalence of mycobacterial tuberculosis in blood cultures was 54%. This is all patients who are age-defining, and 54% of these had mycobacterium TB in the blood cultures. This obviously has important implications for occupational exposures to needle-stick injuries because a lot of our HIV age-defining patients frequently present with mycobacteremia. In fact, mycobacteria are a very, very common and important source of bloodstream infection and positive culture. Moving on to the next slide, you'll see that there are many instances, in fact, where cutaneous tuberculosis has been described following needle stick injuries, and these are actually documented for you. And what is also quite important is that we not only see mycobacterium tuberculosis in the bloodstream, but we also see a wide variety of mycobacteria other than TB, which are common in some of our communities, such as our mining communities. So mycobacterial inoculation of the skin of moths has also been described. The next slide shows, in fact, one of our laboratory workers who was really trying to aspirate fluid from one of these blood culture bottles, and she accidentally sustained a needle stick injury and indeed acquired cutaneous tuberculosis as a consequence. The next slide shows you that parasites also, and this is not just malaria, can be transmitted in the bloodborne fashion. Nosocomial malaria has well been described worldwide, and we certainly have had our fatalities in South Africa. And also other organisms like African trypanosomiasis, sleeping sickness, as well as organisms like Leishmanian toxoplasma, have also actually really been documented. On the following slide, you'll be seeing that nosocomial infection is not just a South African phenomenon. Although we have had a healthcare worker dying of this disease following the phlebotomy procedure of a patient in the late 1990s, the nurse was not aware of the fact that the patient had falciparum malaria, but it was subsequently confirmed. The nurse, because she was simply a phlebotomist, was really not actually suspected of having acquired malaria. She had a pyrexia of unknown origin, the diagnosis was missed, and she was mismanaged. And unfortunately, by the time somebody stumbled upon the diagnosis, she really died 3 weeks after her needle stick injury from falciparum malaria. If you move to the next slide, you'll see that right apart as the UK, West Germany, Poland, and Saudi Arabia, and the references for all of these, in fact, malarial parasites have been transmitted. They've been transmitted by accidental inoculation from patients who have returned from a malaria endemic area to their own country, through needle stick injuries, and indeed even through heparin, dox, contaminated blood, contaminated gloves, and also possibly acquired from an infected skin cut. So do not underestimate malaria. You know that patients travel, they come to our wonderful game reserves and parks, and these are people who certainly may actually acquire infection through this route. Finally, I'm going to end with a few wacky ways of acquiring bloodborne viruses. Contamination of injections and equipment, infusions, transfusions, and medications is well known to you. So the next slide shows you that in Africa specifically and in the developing world, we generally tend to administer too many injections. Each person tends to receive on average 1.5 injections per year. The majority of these are judged unnecessary when they are investigated clinically, and at least 50% of the injections in 14 out of 19 countries that were representing the developing world in this country were deemed to be unsafe. In other words, there was a reuse of needles and there were problems with the way in which, in fact, the injections were being administered, also reuse of the injection itself. And important links were made between unsafe injections and transmission of all of the organisms that I've mentioned, hepatitis B, C, HIV, hemorrhagic fevers, and malaria. I think it's important that it's been shown that unsafe injections really account for a significant proportion of all new hepatitis B and C infections. And in fact, again through unsafe injection practices, a wonderful article came out showing a nosocomial outbreak with not just one bloodborne viral infection, but multiple, to add insult to the injury. Please remember that in Africa, sometimes people are under the illusion that when you aspirate blood, for instance from a drip or a drip port, if you don't see visible blood, it's acceptable to simply change the needle and then deliver whatever is present in the barrel of that syringe to the next patient with a new needle. We know that retrograde contamination occurs the minute you actually move the needle or take it out, and that aspiration may result in small amounts of blood, as small as 2 times 10 to the 5 microliters, entering the syringe. And this constitutes, in effective terms, in terms of bloodborne pathogens, 200 to 2,000 times greater the amount of blood required to transmit hepatitis B to chimpanzees. We've had outbreaks, as has been described in other parts of the world, of bloodborne organisms being delivered through the use of propofol, multidose vial, transfusion, and medication. And I think that all of you can associate with these outbreaks because you will have read about them. The next slide shows contamination of injectables, where in fact we had an outbreak of necrotizing enterocolitis and Enterobacter plaquae infection amongst 9 neonates over a period of 2 weeks. And the source of contamination was extrinsic contamination of the substance on the right-hand side of the slide, a multidose vial containing a vitamin amino acid additive that was given into the drip of premature infants. The hand contamination of the nurses who were grossly overworked and didn't have hand washing facilities is demonstrated, of course, on the plate on the left bottom slide. And when you move to the next slide, you'll see that in order to indicate as an educational feedback tool how easy it is to transmit organisms such as Enterobacter plaquae via contaminated injectables, we did fingerprinting where lanes 2 to 8 really represent a wide variety of isolates from the baby's bloodstream and the environment. Lane 11 represents the exact Enterobacter plaquae strain that was present in the vitamin amino acid cocktail, and lane 13, the same strain that was found on the health of one of the nurses. So this really shows a breakdown of infection control practices and the preponderance of transmission of the strain amongst patients and contamination of the environment in an outbreak situation. Now I'm going to take you to the next slide, which shows you how poor sometimes the containment of waste is, and how again bloodborne diseases may be acquired in this way. On the top right-hand corner of the slide, blood sharps and storage or disposal of waste is an important principle. Syringes and any other injectable material that could contain bloodborne agents that may survive in ambient temperatures will be accessed by people who choose to access these things. Children have been injured in this fashion, intravenous drug abusers look for vehicles for injection, and it's quite irresponsible not to actually dispose of waste in a safe fashion. On the right top-hand side is an incinerator furnace where you can see that the door has fallen off. It's fairly dark, but you can see it on the slide. And this incinerator clearly does not reach temperatures in excess of 1,000 or 5,000 degrees centigrade. You may also see tinfoil in the incinerator containing the sandwich of the incinerator operator, which is getting heated up for his next meal. And this is how, in fact, sharps are so-called destroyed or any other biohazardous material. On the bottom right-hand side, you'll see that in countries like Nigeria, for instance, whatever is not disposed of adequately gets sold on the streets. And this includes central venous catheters, many of which are already still encrusted with blood from previous patients, urinary catheters that are reused. And basically the message is that if you don't dispose of waste responsibly, you may actually introduce through medical paraphernalia a wide variety of potential pathogens into unsuspecting patients who will not get any medical care unless they bring their own equipment to their facility. Fortunately, this is not a South African issue. Very briefly and very quickly, I want to take you to the biggest healthcare facility on the next slide, which is Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, the largest hospital in the world, with approximately 3,700 beds and spanning over many, many acres of land. The next slide will show you how in this huge hospital, this frequently inappropriate disposal of waste. We've now moved to the yellow color coding system for biohazardous waste. So these slides are a little bit old, but you'll see that in fact waste disposal principles are not adhered to. And things like overshoes, for instance, which we don't encourage the use of in our hospitals, and ordinary pieces of paper next to the sink and things that are used to dry hands are placed in biological waste bags, which are marked red or were marked red, they're now yellow. And this waste is disposed of by special disposal companies and costs a huge amount of money to get rid of, when in fact it should be treated as housekeeping waste because of its low infectivity. The next slide shows an interesting event, and this is in fact the removal or stealing of hospital equipment through waste bins. Now if you look at the whole sequence of events, people have accessed waste containers which have been packaged with hospital linen, and there is a box in the red circle. The box is then taken out and, of course, is carried to a so-called waste disposal van right at the end of the hospital where nobody can see, and it's loaded at the back as a box of disposed waste. In fact, three-quarters of the box is filled with stolen equipment, and this is taken away and then sold in more under-resourced areas. And this is a profiteering racket that exists. Now, in those red bags might well be infectious waste, and there may well be sharps that may give rise to needle stick injuries. The next slide again shows, in fact, inadequate waste disposal procedures, and I won't linger on that longer. And then the next slide shows, in fact, probably the most ridiculous practice ever encountered, where when the superintendent was made aware of the fact that linen was stolen, he gave an instruction that all hospital workers, before throwing away waste, had to have these bags searched by a waste searcher to make sure that no hospital equipment or supplies were incorporated in the bags, and expose this poor individual, for instance, although he had gloved hands, to a rummaging through the bag to try and see if there was any stolen equipment. Crazy but true, and that's what happened. Bloodborne organisms can also be spread, next slide, through certain procedures such as circumcision-related sepsis. And imagine when you have an outbreak of strep pyogenes following ritual circumcisions. They usually occur because the same razor blade is used for multiple procedures and multiple initiators during these rites. And all you have to do, simple infection control, is get into an agreement with a traditional healer that sterile and single-use bays will be provided free of charge. And the outcome is that you see no further cases of outbreaks of strep pyogenes. Think of the bleeding following circumcision, and one wonders how many bloodborne infections, such as hepatitis B and HIV, have been transmitted to people during initiation rituals. I'm not going to go into body art, except that it's very popular in South Africa, so we'll move through the next two slides. But I do want you to know that there are lots of infectious complications of body art, especially when it's not carried out properly. And these are described on the slide stating what the infectious complications of body art are. We had an outbreak in South Africa where inkwells in a tattoo parlor, for instance, were contaminated with Pseudomonas aeruginosa, and transcutaneous tattooing and inoculation of these pigments resulted, in fact, infections of these patients. But that's not technically a bloodborne infection. It's really from an inkwell, but some interesting infections have been described. Now, the final thing that I want to show you is the sinister aspect of bloodborne infections, and this is following, in fact, blood theft that was described in our own facility at the Johannesburg Hospital. And this is when, in fact, large amounts of blood clearly labeled as coming from the HIV PCR laboratory or the viral load laboratory was stolen from our facility, and we believe it was used for the first hijacking stick-up, literally stick-up using a syringe filled with virus threat, where a lady was approached by a person with a syringe filled with blood, and the person threatened the lady driver that she would be stabbed or injected with HIV-containing material if she didn't vacate her car and allow the hijacker to make off with it. We also believe that, in fact, possibly a lot of the blood that has been stolen has entered the traditional healer's market, forming so-called booty medicines, which are used to either inflict illness upon people as part of curses, or perhaps similar to some homeopathic principles, use the concept of like, treat likes in some cultures and some traditional beliefs. On the next slide, you'll see the theft of the blood, people breaking through a secure contained area with a door and a security gate, seeing the boxes clearly marked as coming from the PCR laboratory, and seeing that the stolen blood has been actually taken out. And very carefully, from the bottom two slides, you'll see that vacutainer tubes for full blood count have had the caps removed and the blood leaving the intact tube on the left right-hand bottom, on the right bottom portion of the slide, the vacutainer tubes are completely empty. The blood clearly has been very carefully decanted and has either entered a bioterrorist hijack market or the Muti market. So what are the conclusions of our Out of Africa presentation? Firstly, next slide please, the ease of international travel results in high levels of migrancy. So please don't forget that bloodborne pathogens, no matter how exotic, can appear in any of your facilities wherever you are in the world listening to this talk. We frequently have to simplify our infection control procedures by understanding the physical properties, the survival, the biological behavior and transmission of the virus. And by simply doing this, we can simplify and make, in fact, infection control practices as accessible to as many people in the developing countries as possible. The third point is the profile of occupationally transmitted bloodborne pathogens is probably broader on our continents, and the risks may be very different than those described in the developed world. I have mentioned in my talk the high HIV seroprevalence in my country probably mandates an urgent review validation of needle stick and splash injury protocols that we inherit from developed countries such as the United States, especially CDC protocols. The next point is that don't forget that intern and medical student exposure is extremely common but very underreported. And most importantly, next slide, using only nosocomial precautions may not necessarily be the solution. Phlebotomy training is crucial in preventing a large proportion of injuries. And finally, in our country, contaminated blood, reuse of single-use disposable medical paraphernalia, ritual practices, illicit use of blood-contaminated items, and possibly body art all contribute to the transmission of bloodborne viruses. So on the next slide, our intervention priorities include education, obviously introduction of safer techniques to draw blood, and of course getting products and equipment that is appropriate. Skills training is important, and we need to actually have methods to encourage the reporting of blood exposures and the national database. Finally, appropriate disposal of waste, looking at sociocultural practices engaging with traditional healers, offering acceptable alternatives, and investigating ways to minimize the potential for criminal events are of crucial importance. Shakespeare was the first sharp sage with huge infection control knowledge, although most of you don't realize it. He said, "To be or not to be, that is a question. Whether 'tis noble in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune," he was of course referring to all the sharps that we have in healthcare facilities, and the outrageous fortune was of course the outcome of these sharps, "or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing them," obviously he was referring, although the germ theory wasn't understood, but in my interpretation, which is uniquely mine, to obviously using appropriate protective equipment, he summarizes the essence of what you should be doing about bloodborne pathogens. "Rather take arms against the sea of troubles rather than suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune." Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed the presentation. Goodbye.
Well, thank you very much, Adriano, and another outstanding teleclass presentation. Thank you all for joining this teleclass today. Dr. Duzet, it has been, again, a pleasure to share this time with you, and thank you very much for giving us your time and your talent.